then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's New Year's Day, January the 1st, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I was originally planning on taking up this entire show with one long New Year's Day rant telling you guys to pull your socks up, but an hour is a long time to hear anybody just sitting and bloviating, including someone as fascinating as me. So instead, I'm just going to say what I have to say, break it up with some music and a little bit of this and that, and we'll see how long it takes. Okay, first off, since the new year is officially a new beginning and all that, where are we beginning from? Where's our starting point? Where are we now as we begin this year of our Lord 2015? I mean, all of us, the white race in general, Western civilization as a whole. Let's take a look. Now, the first thing that strikes me is that we're 10 years closer to extinction, not one. Our official point of no return, where we become an absolute numerical minority in this country, has been moved forward 10 years to the year 2040. By the assorted census authorities and demographic prognosticators in the groves of academe. And I believe as recently as this time last year, the point of no return was still 2050, at least officially. Now, we're supposed to take comfort in the statistic that, well, you white people will still be the country's largest minority, but in view of the fact that in the year 2040, well, over half of those white people living in this country will be over 60 years of age, and almost a quarter will be over 75. Basically, if we don't do anything before that, then white people are toast. Now, I'm not sure how Canada factors into all this, so I can't give you a statistical overview of the North American continent as a whole, but I'm sure it's almost as bad at the rate which Canada's filling up with non-white immigrants and is keeping white immigration out, which is at least as bad as it is here. Basically, we've got one more bear generation or part of a generation to turn this thing around by physically seizing back a portion of the North American continent for our own racial use and habitation. Or else by the year 2100, there will be no more white people living on the continent except for possibly some very elderly survivors in places like Moose Jaw and maybe some little towns that time forgot out on the Nebraska or North Dakota prairie, something like that. Now, the rest of the United States and Canada will be a mud-colored mass in a state of collapse similar to what we see in Bombay or Brazil today. At best, the large cities will be virtually uninhabitable except for fortified enclaves where the wealthy elite hang out, hoarding what's left of the decreasing store of energy and technology. As white people, especially scientific and technically inclined white males, die off, the world will revert to a far more primitive era. A lot of technology will be lost, but then who the hell needs Twitter anyway? I don't think we'll quite return to the Bronze Age. I don't think we'll lose everything techie, but I think there's going to be a lot less of it. Mad Max world? Maybe. Eventually, the shit-skinned masses will break out of the cities or simply leave, and in vast mobs or tribal migrations, they will begin wandering across the continent in search of food and energy, like hordes of locusts, consuming every natural resource and devouring everything in their path as they go. They will devour what is left of the white population along the way, unless the whites can finally get rid of this psychological bar we have had installed in our brains against spilling black and brown blood and bring themselves to fight. Although when things have reached that point, I'm not sure it would be possible. I can foresee literal human waves of black and brown descending on little towns like Grinnell, Iowa, and overrunning it like an incoming tide. Now, even if some of our descendants do recover enough courage at the last minute to raise their hand to crack a nappy head or breach a brown hide, it may simply be too late. There may be just plain too many of them. Never forget the incredible rate at which dark people breed. It is the one characteristic of theirs which has defeated us, along with our own laziness and stupidity and cowardice, of course. I put that in about 25 years or so. I won't live to see it, because with the state of health care in the society and my present medical problems, I really can't see myself making it to 86. But a lot of you listening to this podcast will quite likely live to see it. What government of the United States there will be third world in every sense of the term, which is to say not just black and brown, but corrupt, incompetent, and efficient to the point of being effectively non-functional. And by that time, the United States will, of course, be a one-party Democrat state, probably ruled over in name by a Clinton or Kennedy dynasty, with symbolic re-elections every 4 years against a completely controlled and ornamental opposition. The Republican Party will not represent the interests of the white man, even in the feeble and half-assed way it presently pretends to do. All pretense will be gone. Any Republicans who have been allowed to survive the purges when they became bloody, as they will be a few old brown men like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are just sort of kept around as window dressing and allowed to wander through the crumbling halls of Congress, mumbling to themselves. The FBI and the secret police agencies that keep the democratic dictatorship in power will probably be the only arms of government that function with anything like efficiency. And the vast internal spying network that the NSA and the Democrat one-party state maintains will be one of the few operations that's still maintained with any degree of maintenance and effort. Oh, and the prisons, of course. Got to have them. Can't have even a third world country without prisons. I don't even want to think about what the prison system is going to be like in this country in 25 years. Most likely a kind of third world version of Stalin's gulag system. I guess about the only benefit of becoming extinct as a race is that the bastards can't put any more white men and women into those places. This country will be Brazil, at best, assuming that the mestizos, who will be the largest minority, can manage in some way to keep at least some rudimentary vestige of social and legal order going. Now, this will probably be accomplished in the mid or later part of the century by doing what the ANC has done in South Africa. Those Kaffirs have sense enough to understand that they themselves are too stupid to maintain a modern technological society, keep up the infrastructure, etc., etc. And so they keep a few million tame white people as pets, as a kind of technocratic elite to make sure that all the machines work, keep the electricity on in Johannesburg and Cape Town, keep the air conditioning running and the street lights working, keep the water and the sewage plants pumping in at least a half-assed way, although I understand that's breaking down now. You get the idea. This tiny elite will consist mostly of geeky white males living in fortified compounds or apartment high-rises like in the movie Soylent Green. Physically weak little white boys with big heads who have been raised from birth by computers and the media to be high-tech servants to their black and brown masters. They will be highly encouraged to be homosexual, but if not, if they are fortunate, they might be allowed a pretty little Asian girlfriend provided by the state or some corporation connected with the power structure. Now, my guess is that the present trend of preventing and interdicting sexual relationships between white men and women will continue, because the Jews and the soulless beings of incredible wealth who run the Soylent Green world will want to keep white births down to a very low, controllable level. And all white babies born, especially boys, will be carefully monitored and nurtured growing up for their technical abilities only. Now, the powers that be don't want any rogue white boys suddenly erupting in an anachronistic fit of world conquest or space exploration or discovery. The powers that be will want to keep the status quo just as it is on the world consumer plantation. Now, in this way, the liberal, democratic, one-party state will keep things going as best they can until roughly, 2070, 2080. Then, when it's obvious that whatever remains of the United States can no longer defend itself, the Chinese will move in. There will ensue a period of unspeakable mass bloodshed, the worst in human history. The niggers will either be exterminated or re-enslaved for their manual labor, and the brown Mexicans and Hapas and weird Asian nigger Mexican mixes like the Filipinos will be forced into permanent subordination and eventually absorbed into the Chinese masses. By the year 2115 or so, the North American continent will be completely Chinese, and the last remaining signs that any of us white boys were ever here will be obliterated in a kind of Beijing or Hong Kong-like anthill. Will there be any white people left in the world at all by the year 2100? Maybe New Zealand or Australia or Russia? Russia maybe, if they can stay strong under Putin's successor and not give in to the liberal, progressive, multicultural poison from the West. Now, so far, they're doing well. those Cossack whips descending on those Pussy Riot bitches definitely gave me hope for Russia's future. But I'll tell you this, the white man's ability to survive anywhere in this world, even into the 22nd century, is dependent on his eventual willingness to take weapons into his hands and kill his enemies. Now, when people ask me, why, Harold, why? Why are things like this? How did it get like this? I have a simple one-sentence answer for them. The white man no longer kills his enemies, and the enemies have figured it out. No one respects someone who does not kill his enemies. He is viewed as a mark, as a victim, as prey. And so he should be. Now, any man or race or civilization that will not fight when its very existence is threatened will die. Tapping on a computer is not fighting. Standing on a street corner holding a sign and letting scum throw rocks and bottles and garbage at you is not fighting. And fair enough, talking into a microphone and doing a podcast is not fighting either. I'm just as guilty of preserving my own hide as anyone else. I'm nothing special. I'm simply making an observation. The white man will either fight in the literal physical sense of combat or he will perish from the face of the earth. It's not even a matter of he deserves to die. Despite what some hysterical white people in the white nationalist movement say, deserves has got nothing to do with it. We're talking nature's law here. And nature's law is cold and rational and makes no allowances for sentiment or morality or moralistic judgments. White racial extinction is going to happen if we don't fight. That's just the way it is. The old America is gone. It cannot help us anymore, and it will never return. The old America we were born into died on November 20th, 2014, when a president of the United States signed a decree that changed the very nature of American society. Barack Hussein Obama did so without even any pretense of consultation with the people's elected representatives. Barack Hussein Obama did so not only in disregard of the United States Constitution, but in direct defiance of it. Barack Hussein Obama did the very thing that the entire Constitution and the structure of the democratic small-d government was laid out by the Founding Fathers to prevent. He ruled like a king, and nothing was done about it. It is now clear that nothing will be done about it. And this is why and how America ended. Not because of what was done, but because of what was not done. This is Brian from Illinois.
Hello, Radio Free Northwest listeners. I'm glad to speak to you for a moment today. I just want to say a little bit about the South African community called Orania. It's a small community of Afrikaners who have set up their own white-only community where they can live apart from the blacks. And it's been kind of a success story along the lines of the PLE. It's like the only one that I've really heard of. Well, I saw on the net the other day that the South African Supreme Court has decided that they have to allow blacks in. Why blacks would want to live in the middle of the veld, away from their kinfolk, in a small, small town of like 1,000 people is beyond me. I think it's just because they don't want the white man to have anything in South Africa. And I think a lot of white nationalists look at South Africa as an example of what happens when things go wrong. Oh, it's so bad. There's 3 million white people stuck there and they're just all gonna die or have to leave. But I don't think that's the case. I think if you look through human history, when people are under the most pressure, that's when something happens. Kind of like when you put coal under pressure, it makes a diamond, the hardest substance known. And I really think that South Africa could very well be the beginning of the worldwide white revolution, because those white people there are under so much pressure that they're going to have to either fight or die. It kind of reminds me of a story I heard about this tribe in Central Europe during the time of the Roman Empire that was forced into the boundaries of the Roman Empire by another tribe, and they were starving to death. And the Romans begrudgingly allowed them access into the empire, but taxed them heavily, made slaves of them, and just really brutally mistreated them to the point that this little ragtag tribe attacked and overthrew like many legions of Roman soldiers because they were desperate. They had to. They had no choice. So I think that is a good allegory with what's going on in South Africa today. And I would like to see more of our efforts directed towards those listening ears over there, because if anybody is uncomfortable, if anybody is thinking about doing something, it's them. And I think that would be the most fertile ground. So that's just my little two cents. Hope you guys had a good Christmas. Happy New Year. And God bless you all.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Going into 2015, we all, and I don't just mean the party, I mean all of us, need to curb a trend I've observed in white nationalism over 2014. Harold hinted at this concept a couple of times last year, but it was only in passing, and as of late, I'm becoming genuinely worried about some of you. By the by, I'm preparing this material on the Sunday before the New Year, and wouldn't you know it, just today, something else showed up in my email inbox which fits right in. The party gets all sorts of email about excited potential migrants. For that, we're grateful, but most of these emails speak volumes by what they do not include. Missing from all of the racial accolades, enthusiasm, ideas, suggestions, and sometimes odd demands, is thought given to how someone is going to support themselves after they come home. I know this because there's very little thought, if any, given to how most people are going to support themselves prior to coming home. And before any of you get the idea I'm coming down on people for having a run of bad luck, I'm not. The entire white race is about to have a run of hard luck one way or the other. And further, I and the rest of the party are very aware of the economic reality all over the country and the world. This isn't about judging you. It's about pointing out reality and dealing with it. My personal favorite example of someone completely avoiding reality is an angry email a kid out east sent Harold some time ago. It boiled down to this guy haranguing the party for expecting people to migrate when it's impossible for anyone to get a job anymore. Remember, gang, even if the Northwest Imperative never existed, you would still need to support yourself somehow. Getting mad at us for pointing out the obvious isn't going to do much for you. There have been times in my own life where I was forced into taking some really awful and dirty jobs to feed myself. I'm not just speculating about how the world works. You have to support yourself, period. Earlier last year, I received a very long email which mostly asked for some life choice advice. I'm flattered when this happens, but seriously, guys, I'm not a counselor, life coach, or personal development guru. I could tell this guy really needed a response, so I spent time doing my best for him. For the record, and I do want all of you out there to pay attention to me, that's going to be a one-off. I'm not doing it again. This is not my field of expertise, nor do I have any experience in it. Further, people's personal situations are just that. Personal. I don't know you. Because of this, I don't have the ability to tell if you're exaggerating your circumstances or leaving out information you would rather not admit to yourself or someone else. Without actually knowing you, I can't give you a legitimate answer. And much, much more important, most of the emails and other communications received don't really ask us the questions which need asking. We're always encouraged to hear from those of you who are genuinely interested in Northwest migration. But in the cases I'm thinking of today, the expressions of hope, racial solidarity, Northwest aspirations, and all that good stuff gloss right over the reality that employment is an issue. And no, I do not mean employment in the homeland following migration. Again, there's nothing wrong with having genuinely bad luck with employment issues. It can happen to the best of us. There's been quite a bit of discussion among the local party associates of how we're going to handle this sort of situation moving forward. If we detect someone dealing with us is in severe economic distress, we're going to give them the advice I'm giving you all today. Like I said, Harold hinted at this recently, but I'm going to come right out and say it. Fix yourself first. And do nothing else but fix yourself first. If your existence is so precarious that you've literally got nothing going for you other than white nationalism as a computer game, drop the white nationalism. No, really. You're not doing yourself any favors, and this is the best advice you could get. You don't have time or energy to spare on anything else apart from fixing your own circumstances. The Northwest Front does need your help. But outside of very rare exceptions, you can't help us unless you're on your own 2 feet in the homeland, and you can't pull that off unless you're on your own 2 feet right now. We wouldn't be doing you any sort of favor if we encouraged you along in migration and party work while you're not functional in society. Whatever you think you need to ask the party when you get a hold of us, put that on the back burner for a moment or two and seriously consider whether or not you have skills someone wants to pay you money for and whether or not you're currently plying those skills. This goes for everyone, too, not just the currently unemployed. Someone got a hold of us on the party message board many months ago. He was, of course, quite interested in the idea of the Northwest Imperative, but made it clear he wasn't going to migrate. His reason? It turns out his company didn't have any locations in the Northwest, so it would be somehow impossible for him to move. This is, of course, quite a shock to me because people are increasingly doing their scouting trips and coming home, even though this guy can't for some reason. Look, guys, outside of a legally binding commitment, if you can only work for your current employer, you're at serious risk of ending up in a bad, bad way. Do something about that, please. If you're in a school or college of some sort, are you making a good choice? I'm not saying drop out, but I am saying make sure you're spending your time and money such that you're able to support yourself when you're done. If not, do something about it. Now, not later. If you're entering your mid-20s having little to no work experience, you'd better fix that up immediately. It doesn't matter what job you get, just get one now. And keep it, too. I notice those leaving the military frequently struggle to find employment. That's unfortunate, yes, but even more unfortunate is that leaving the military is usually a predictable event. Considering what the economy is like, would it not be a good idea to get a plan and start working it before you find yourself in a bind? And lastly, if you're still in high school, don't screw it up! The email item I mentioned earlier is representative of a shockingly large proportion of party interactions. The person who sent it is very nearly illiterate. This isn't rare, either. If you can't read and write well, you have very little chance of learning a marketable skill in the modern world. I know how this sounds, but unless such a person has a track record of keeping a decent job, we almost always write them off unless they turn themselves around. On average, the Northwest is a better educated and higher earning region of the country than nearly all the others. And someone who can't compose written communication isn't going to stand a chance. I'll close today with the observation that many in this situation are so because they waited too long in dealing with the underlying problems. Don't do that. And further, don't expect the Northwest Front to provide you a distraction and thereby enable such behavior. Hail victory, comrades.
And here's a little song about the pre-Ferguson days and how they used to deal with black crime back then. This is Adrian Young and Little Sadie.
Born in bad blood, raised on me. been murdering mud. Only good thing in this house all is Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. Dead and gone, dead and gone. Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. Well, Sheriff Ted Tucker saw the mob on the street, and he radioed every cop on the beat. Send the warnings given, questions asked. Just find this Rastus and find him fast. Cuffs on him. Rastus Russell, born in bad blood, raised on misery, murder and mud. Only good thing in this our song is Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. What did ever broke out of that Clearwater jail? Rastus did and left a bloody trail. Red handprints on a stolen truck. Yeah, Rastus was running out of luck. Some kind won't stop at anything. He was digging up his mama for a diamond ring. In the graveyard there, they laid him low. That's a fitting end to this tale of woe. Rastus Russell, born a bad blood. Raised on misery, murder and blood. Only good thing in this old song. Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. Rastus Russell, born a bad blood. Raised on misery, murder and blood. Only good thing in this old song. Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. Dead and gone, dead and gone. Rastus Russell is a dead and gone. Dead and gone.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to talk about Savitri Devi's Defiance. Now, this is a book that was written probably in 1949, but it's discussing the events of 1948. But at this time, as we know, Savitri Devi is traveling in Germany by train, and she's passing out a lot of posters and pamphlets. She decides to give some of her dangerous posters to a former SS officer that she meets on the train, and she promises to see him in about a week. Now, at this point, Savitri is under divine protection, and the force that protects the cause speaks to Savitri and tells her to go directly to her pre-planned destination, not to bother with the SS officer. But she doesn't listen to this because she's very desperate for companionship. And she ends up looking for him. Now, as it turns out, he has already been arrested. And because of that, Savitri is also found out. And she ends up going to jail. Now, she is interviewed by a psychiatrist. And she talks about her love of England because of its Nordic heritage and her love for Greece because of the Greek ideal. But she says that she loves Germany most of all as a symbol of National Socialism, which is an ideology that she loves for its beauty. Now, the psychiatrist realizes that Savitri has no ties, and thus she is in freedom with no moral conflicts. Savitri learns that she's going to go before a military tribunal and that she could potentially be condemned to death. Now, she embraces the idea of martyrdom And in court, she decides to make a rousing speech. In this speech, she praises Germans as the first among the awake. Because of this, she gets a 3-year sentence, and this is the heaviest sentence ever given to a woman by a British court. Because she is not a war criminal, and also because they fear she will spread propaganda, Savitri is put in the common wing, and also because she comes under the British justice system, because of her complicated citizenship situation, she is given better rations than the Germans are. Now, she often shares her rations with the Germans, and because of her desperation for comradeship, she really abuses and stretches her privileges while she is in prison, and at one point even gives some literature to a comrade in D-Wing. Now, she shouldn't even be associating with those in D-Wing. And she has a lot of premature exhibitions of her feelings. Now, at one point in late May, her cell is searched and her manuscripts that she's working on are confiscated. Now, at this point, she is reprimanded by some of her comrades who are punished because they've let Savitri get away with too much. And she also reprimands herself. She thinks about how she was not in Germany during the Reich. And she also reprimands herself for not bringing financial help, which she wanted to bring but was not able to bring because of the laws at the time. And she goes through a lot of self-questioning, and she realizes that unseen powers may protect her manuscript if it is deemed valuable to the cause. Also, she realizes that expediency is important, and when she sees the psychiatrist for a second time, she wants to appear unbalanced but harmless, and she convinces the psychiatrist that her book would be a harmless personal satisfaction if she were allowed to keep her manuscript. She talks about how happiness is for inferiors and also for animals, but elites will think only of duty. And she prays to be free of all attachment. She wants a one-pointed freedom from all personal ties, and she doesn't want to escape the cause, but she wants action freed from all selfishness. And she realizes that when the cause needs expedience, she will be expedient in the name of detachment. The cause is organized by eternal principles, and therefore any action is justified in its service, and she pledges absolute obedience to the best of her understanding. She realizes that she's nothing but an instrument of the cause, and she's not clever, but she's privileged to be on the side of the truth, and that gloating is as bad as squeamishness. You can tell that she has difficulty in maintaining complete detachment because when she is called the most objectionable type of National Socialist that one of her captors has ever met, and this is a captor that has dealt with war criminals, she feels proud, and thus she is still struggling with detachment. Now, she realizes that nothing is too precious a sacrifice, and during this ordeal, she uses a mantra to connect with these unseen powers. Now, on the 17th of June, after going through this dark night of the soul, her manuscript is returned to her, both manuscripts, both The Lightning and the Sun, and also Gold in the Furnace. Now, Savitri sees this as a sign that her manuscripts will be useful to the cause, and also that victory will eventually be attained. But she's told by one of her comrades, "Do not be in haste for victory." Now, Savitri is asked if victory would come, what would you want? And Savitri asks for no praise, she asks for no honors, but she does ask to be a citizen of the Reich. Now, she is reminded and reprimanded not to be in any kind of childish haste for victory, and she prays that she will be free of all vanity and all childish haste and all pettiness, and she asks the unseen forces to save our cause, which is thine. Of course, she wishes to remain in Germany. She even thinks that at the end of her life, when the time comes, she wishes that she could die in Germany. But she is told that because of her orthodoxy, it would be safer for her to go to France. Now, she thinks about the unseen forces that control the occupation and allow it. And she knows that only they know how long the occupation will be allowed to last. But she says that at the end of the day, any survivors, any who still believe in the movement or who believe in the divine order, that they, of course, will come to National Socialism. And so she has this undying faith in victory. With that, she goes off to France and I suppose eventually off to India in order to continue her writing. Now, it's true, in the early 50s, she comes back to Germany under her maiden name. Now, I found this book very moving and in a sense also very depressing. I found it very easy to identify with Savitri's loneliness. And she's lonely both because of her political views and also her religious views. It's very easy to feel the loneliness and the desperation that she felt, as many of us feel when we are in situations when we cannot be with our comrades, or for whatever reason, we must endure those who are against our view of the world. Now, I also found this a very valuable document because it discusses the important principle of detachment. I think it behooves us all to read this book and to pray for detachment and to pray for the kind of selflessness that Savitri prays for. And I know that she did not always achieve detachment, but I think that detachment can be achieved. I wanted to discuss this at this point because we're going into the new year and this is a time to think about what we want for ourselves in the future. And it certainly behooves us all to pray for this degree of attachment because it is in this detachment and in this selflessness that we achieve divine protection from that which sustains the cause. So thank you for listening and hail victory, comrades.
Okay, I just played back the first part of the podcast, and it's true, I guess I got a little extreme at the end of my first segment there. And in the past few weeks, I've had some of you telling me, look, Harold, you have to cool it on the revolutionary rhetoric. The secret police have been arresting people for years now for things they say on the internet. You have to be careful, we need you, etc., etc. Okay, let me just deal with that whole subject now, hopefully for the entire year of 2015, and then having said my piece, I won't have to harp on it in the months to come. First off, yes, I am aware of the fact that, like the rest of the Constitution, the First Amendment now exists on the sufferance of the FBI and the emerging one-party dictatorship, and that we have only as much freedom of speech as the regime decides to allow us to have. Now, some people, such as Edgar Steele and Bill White and Johnny Logan Spencer, are allowed to have none at all. Some people like Edgar Steele, and I'm very much afraid Bill White as well, are not even allowed to live. Why have I not been scooped up and charged with hiring a hitman to kill Khloe Kardashian, or sexually molesting llamas in the Seattle Zoo, or whatever bird-brained nonsense the FBI decides to fabricate, complete with audio tapes? Why not? I have no idea. I have no idea on earth what goes on in the mind of an FBI agent. Its thought processes are completely alien to me. I do not, in fact, break the law, which, of course, no longer matters. Although forcing the FBI to engage in acts of complete fabrication from the ground up does make things more challenging for them. Now, it could be that they're going to try and get me on taxes this year. As we now know, thanks to the Drudge Report and a few other people in the alternative media who won't let the story go, this regime has a history of using the IRS to suppress political dissent. Once again, nothing was done about it, and the Jewish woman who heads the agency was allowed to flip Congress the bird and simply ignore inconvenient questions. And nothing was done about her any more than anything was done about that stupid mulatto Eric Holder when he got caught shipping guns to Mexican drug cartels. Now, the lack of any kind of accountability among Democrats is complete, and it runs from top to bottom, the head of the IRS and the U.S. Attorney General and the main mungoid in the White House himself, on down to the lowest nappy-headed foot soldier in Acorn or the SEIU or Occupy Wall Street, to the gun-toting goons of the FBI. Liberal Democrats operate without any accountability or adverse consequences for anything they do, and so they do anything they want. This is one of the hallmarks of tyranny. Yeah, I suppose they could get me on taxes if they want, since the tax code is so incredibly complex that even IRS agents of many years' experience don't understand it, and it's almost impossible to file a return at all without violating some little regulation or other. So, yeah, they could go over my 2014 return with a fine-tooth comb and probably find some I not dotted or some T not crossed. But the trouble is, though, I don't make any money. I was actually audited back in 1999, which would have been on my 98 return, and I ended up owing the regime $15 and some change. And my situation hasn't changed much since then. Whatever they found wrong would probably be only a matter of a few $100s, and I'm not sure they want to spend $100,000 to prosecute me, and then millions to keep me locked up for the rest of my life over $400 or $500. Yeah, I know, they got David Duke, but Duke stuck $235,000 in his pocket over about 14 months that they know about, that they were able to pin on him. And he was also living like he was James Bond or whatever fantasy he was fulfilling, and going to riverboat gambling casinos and down to the Bahamas with blonde arm candy on his arm. In my case, I drive a 17-year-old car and live in a tenement, and I don't even eat Mickey D's anymore, not just for health reasons, but because the fast food has become just too expensive. Do they really want to make a federal income tax case out of some guy who is barely one cut above homeless? I don't know. Maybe they do, if that's all they can come up with, to make me be quiet, which is the object of the exercise. Look, the point I'm trying to make here is that whatever these people are going to do, they're going to do. I have no control over what they do. No one does, and that's the problem. So I just don't worry about it. I'm not trying to be melodramatic or narcissistic or any kind of drama queen when I tell you this. I'm simply stating a fact of life which all of us have to live with. I am not going to be here forever. I am going to be removed from the chessboard, either through something medical or because the dictatorship fabricates some kind of bogus legal case against me. Or one day the FBI may simply knock on my door and gun me down when I open it, which, under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, they can lawfully do, so long as they have in their pocket a piece of paper authorizing it signed by the President of the United States or, quote-unquote, competent federal authority, which is generally held to be the Attorney General of the United States. Eric Holder. Wow, he's really capable of making that call. But in practice, as far as I can tell, it can be any United States attorney anywhere in the country. It's called extrajudicial execution. It now has a recognized legal existence and a set of protocols. And it has already been carried out on a number of U.S. citizens abroad, quite openly. The dictatorship claims it has never done this in the U.S. itself to native-born American citizens. But there is a very strong possibility we know of in at least two instances where it looks like it was done. First is the case of a journalist named Michael Hastings down in California in June 2013, and the case of Edgar Steele last September. Now, over the next year, I will be doing some things which I will explain to those of you who receive the Northwest Front organizational letter in order to see if we can streamline our operation here as much as we have anything to streamline, get a somewhat bigger bang for our very small buck, and above all, to make sure that I don't leave a National Alliance-style clusterfuck behind me when I do kick it, one way or the other. Thank you for your genuine concern for me, all of you who've spoken to me about this. But speaking out is my duty station within the movement. Somebody has to say these things that everybody knows, but everybody is afraid to say out loud. I have to say it without fear, and it has to be me because no one else will. Story of my life. Okay, now, speaking of Dutch uncles, question for you. How much trouble am I going to get into with goat-dancing fools yelling, "Girl's a communist! Girl's a communist!" if I play the Internationale on here? So you folks can get a sense of history, and so that you can recognize the song when you hear it. Kind of like being shown pictures of enemy uniforms, aircraft and naval vessels in the military, so that you'll know the enemy when you see him, or in this case, hear him. Well, what the hell? The people who say that, most of them have no idea on earth what a communist actually is, anyway. This is the Internationale. It is, in fact, the worldwide anthem of Marxist socialism. It was originally written in French by Eugène Potier in 1871 in order to commemorate the fallen Paris Commune, which was the first briefly successful attempt in history at a Marxist revolt. It's been translated into just about every language on earth, but this is the Russian version.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from the great Republic of Texas. I'm on my way down to Sulphur Springs to deliver a load, and then got to go over by DFW area and pick up a load so I can get back up to the homeland in time enough for Christmas. And currently I'm working my way through the summer of 2012 on the podcast, and I just got done listening to Comrade Andy Donner talking about migration and stuff, which got me thinking about talking about job change in your migration. 15 years ago, I was forced to get out of the maritime industry and decided to go and hop into trucking. Yeah, took a pay cut. But now my little roof over my head is now paid off, and so I didn't have to migrate and stuff because I was already up here in the homeland. But just think, I was just got to thinking last night, well, let's see how my old employer is doing, and it's no longer there. It packed up and left about a week ago, it turns out. So I am certainly glad that I was forced to find new employment 15 years ago rather than having to go and do it now 15 years older. So the longer you put off your migration up here to the homeland, the harder it's going to be because the older you're going to be. Yeah, I'm just a few years younger than Mr. Covington and stuff, but yeah, as you get older and stuff, things get harder. And so the younger you are, or the earlier you start your migration and stuff, the better off you will be. Trust me, yeah. Yeah, I think you'd be better off moving out of your whatever area you're in now. If you have vices like beer, hey, we have beer up here. We've got the Budweiser's or Pisswater beer, plus we have some good microbreweries up here in this area. But you really shouldn't be looking to migrate and stuff. You need to be saving your shekels so you can put it towards your move up here. If you're not into driving moving truck, like I've said before, you could go and get one of those pods, little rental things. They'll drop it off in your driveway. You can load it up. They'll come pick it up and deliver it to the homeland for you. And you could also, if you are so inclined, go and purchase a container storage unit. They're like, I think about, depending on your area, your country, the area of the country you're in, probably $5,000, maybe $7,000. And when you get up here in the homeland, you can have a storage shed that's all yours. You just pack your stuff in it and have a shipping company come pick it up and either put it on a flatbed truck or on a train or however they're going to transport it, whatever you can find economically feasible, and get your household goods moved up here to the homeland. So there's a few options for you, but the sooner you do it, the better off you are, because the older you are, the harder it's going to get to go and be able to pull your move off. So migrate younger rather than older. All right, comrades, this is a trucker signing off from Texas. Have a good one, comrades, and hope to see you in the homeland soon.
Okay, got my music breaks a little lopsided here, and now I'm starting to run long, so I'll just close the whole show with song number 3 like I do sometimes, and that'll give me more uninterrupted time to rant and rave here. Now, by the way, getting back to a previous topic real quick, there has in fact been at least one other known instance of extrajudicial execution in the United States, that being a man named Ibrahim Todashev in Orlando, Florida. The FBI kind of split the difference on him because while he was in the United States, he wasn't an American. He was a Chechen. In May of 2013, Todashev was placed under a kind of house arrest in his own apartment in Orlando, where he was interrogated for almost 8 hours about something to do with the Boston Marathon bombing. Apparently, he knew the Tsarnaev brothers, or the secret police thought he did. Now, either Todashev wouldn't tell them anything, or else he did tell them something, and they didn't like what they were hearing, and the FBI decided he couldn't be allowed to tell anybody else, and so they shot him 6 times in the front and once in the back of the head as he lay on the floor. One interesting thing I found when I was looking this up on the internet to check my dates is that the story is now being quietly cleaned up on the net from what was originally reported at the time, and which original reporting I remember because I've covered this before. The time Todashev spent under unlawful detention in his own home without a lawyer, and so far as anyone knows without being Mirandized, is now down to 2 hours instead of the originally reported 8.5 hours, and the Boston bombing has now virtually disappeared from the story. Todashev is now, quote-unquote, a mixed martial arts champion who is being questioned about a, quote-unquote, grisly triple murder who, quote-unquote, lunged at the FBI men with a sword, which they appear to have finally decided on as the weapon. In earlier versions of the story, it was a kitchen knife, a pair of scissors, and that old favorite, a flare gun. Now, the RCMP said Jeff Hughes had a flare gun as well, so that woman cop just had to fire 10 bullets into his body and then get shipped off to Ontario, where no one's been able to question her in 5 years. Sorry, I'm rambling again. Now, you know, I was going to turn this first podcast of 2015 into a mighty and epic speech along the line of the Gettysburg Address or Camille Desmoulins inciting the mob to storm the Bastille. I actually started working on such a speech, and then I realized that I wasn't saying anything I hadn't said about 50 times before. Instead, I need to give you guys some good news for a change, so here it is. What's in store for the Northwest Front in the year 2015? Well, good news, folks. Harold has finally decided to stop being so stubborn. I'm going to admit to you that I am, in reality, a Harry Potter-like wizard. I'm finally going to take the magic beans out of my pocket. Those magic beans that all of you knew darn well that I had, but which I so perversely hid away from you. I will scatter them on the ground, and a mighty political party and movement complete with freestanding headquarters and flags and flunkies and costumes and all kinds of bells and whistles is just going to spring up out of the earth so that all of you can go ooh and ah and admire and applaud while other people do all of this for you. I will finally appear before you in all my majesty as your savior. My age and my medical problems and my extreme destitution vanished by magic, bestriding my white horse with my cape fluttering in the wind behind me, and my gleaming saber flourished aloft. You guys don't have to worry now. I'm finally going to quit harassing you and pestering you and scolding you and making you feel bad about yourselves, and I will just go ahead and do it all for you. And when it's over, you can all plop down on the sofa with a bowl of salty snacks and a nice cold beer and pick up the remote and surf the tube and see what's on tonight. Look, guys, I don't know how often I can keep coming up with different ways to say the same thing. Now, you know that little scenario I just described? I think that even at my age, I could maybe give something like that a shot, if and when you provide me with the manpower and the resources, and by that I don't mean necessarily dig into your own pockets. Yes, I know most white people are financial basket cases after 6 years of Obama depression. That's what the 10x1000 program is designed to work around. Or better yet, the 10x3000 program, which you people could implement tomorrow morning if you wanted to. Despite all my urging, I don't even expect more than a handful of you to distribute any physical hard copy literature and thus incur the risk that you might get caught and other people will find out about you, which terrifies most of you beyond all measure. The thought that they might find out about you, that maybe even your employer or the little woman might find out that your mind is not properly under control and that you're thinking bad thoughts, just drives most of you bonkers. I understand that. Now, you are what you are, and I do not expect mice to roar. What I do expect you to do is post, which you can do with safety. Post to the internet and bring people to northwestfront.org so we can break through what appears to be our ceiling of approximately 5,000 hits per week. Now, you know why it's been so low for so long? because I can't persuade any significant number of you to take it out of our own little so-called movement circles. You do nothing but preach to the choir lest somebody find out about you. You're hanging out on Stormfront and VNN, where any link to northwestfront.org is actually banned by the moderators because we're the competition, and they want those $10 and $20 bills in the mail to be going to Don Black and Alex Linder and not the Northwest Republic. You should be doing everything you can to bring northwestfront.org in front of the eyes of people who have most likely never seen a racial or nationalist website before in their lives. You're not doing that, and so we're stuck. Now, let me run this down for the first time in 2015. I wish I could say it'll be the last time. It won't be. I don't know what to do except to keep on saying these things and saying them and hoping that here and there, the little light bulbs will start coming on over you guys' heads. Now, do any of you born after about 1970 even get that reference? Look, I'll take the biggest bull by the horns first. One of the main problems the Northwest Front has is me. I do not present well in person for several reasons. People read my books and listen to my podcasts, and they come here expecting to find some right-wing Lenin, and instead they find Homer Simpson, or more accurately, these days they find Grandpa Simpson, an aging, very ordinary man of 61 in indifferent health, living in a tenement, driving a piece of shit 17-year-old car, who buys his clothes from Walmart and Goodwill Industries. Now, people are not impressed, and I get that. The reason I live like that is simple. It's all I barely have the money to live like. But you are Americans, and this is not what you want to see and hear. You have been conditioned all your life to gravitate to one thing, money. For many years, I've been trying to get you people to respond like Europeans who lived 100 years ago to ideas alone. And I'm finally being forced in my old age to accept that for the overwhelming majority of you, it can't be done. That aspect of the white racial character seems to have been socially engineered out of most of you. You have been conditioned from birth to feel, not to think, to be consumers, not creators. Smart shoppers who expect bang for your buck, which the NF doesn't give you because there's not enough buck to make any kind of a real bang with it. No, this isn't a fund appeal. I'm just explaining why I'm going to have to spend a lot of time talking about money in 2015 to the point where I'm probably going to start sounding like Jim Baker trying to build a water park at Heritage USA. You want the bang, you gotta give me the buck. With the greatest of reluctance, I have been dragged kicking and screaming to the conclusion that at some point in the future, the Northwest Front will probably have to do some things that I have spent many years resisting. I will be getting into this in the future, mostly in the confidential organizational letter, in view of who we've got listening to these podcasts. Now, to some degree, we will probably have to return to what might be called the old ways, because whether we like it or not, and I don't like it, it is what is expected of us by the people whose personal participation and support we must have. I have just spent many years telling you guys that the old ways don't work. Well, I may have to modify that a bit. It's not that the old ways won't work, it's the new white people who don't work. Now, as I have mentioned, originally I was going to spend this entire podcast doing nothing but ranting and raving about founding a new order within the new order, so to speak, and then do what? I think that's probably one change I need to be making. A lot less talking about what I'm going to do and a lot more doing what I'm going to do. Well, I think we could all stand to be comporting ourselves in that manner. Okay, I don't really have the time to get more into this, but I will in coming podcasts and organizational letters. Now, on the upside, some good things began in 2014, and we're going to see the results of those good things in the coming year. No kidding. I would especially like to thank a small number of you out there who helped me with a very special project during 2014, which I can't talk about. No, I mean, I literally can't talk about it. But you small, special group of people know what I refer to. The time is not yet right, although I personally believe that someday this story will be told. In the meantime, thank you all from the bottom of my heart. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Hushabugle, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together at the rising of the moon. And come tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, at the old spot by the river, quite well known to you and me. One more word for signal token, whistle out the marching tune, with your pike upon your shoulder, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, at the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud-walled cabin, eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly heart was beating for the blessed morning light. Murmurs rang along the valley to the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand pikes were flashing by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. And a thousand lights were flashing by the rising of the moon. All along that singing river, that black mass of men was seen. High above their shining weapons flew their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, whistle out the marching tune. And hurrah, me boys, for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon. Tis the rising of the moon, 'tis the rising of the moon. And hurrah, me boys, for freedom.